From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Neil Patrick Harris is probably best known for his TV work, first as a teenage doctor in Doogie Howser, M.D., and now in his current sitcom, How I Met Your Mother. He's been nominated for an Emmy for that. But he's also a talented singer. He's performed in a couple of Stephen Sondheim musicals, and he now sings on the Joss Whedon internet musical miniseries, Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. Also, a man who's known for his singing and songwriting, Paul Anka. Recently, he was given the 2008 Johnny Mercer Award by the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Anka wrote the Sinatra anthem My Way and the theme for The Tonight Show, as well as the teen hits Diana and Puppy Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
So that's, you know, coming along. I'm working with a vocal coach, strengthening the...
That's Neil Patrick Harris, practicing his evil laugh as the aspiring title villain of Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Dr. Horrible is a three-part mini-musical created for the internet, with music, lyrics, and plot co-written by Joss Whedon of Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame. It's as good as the classic musical episode Whedon wrote for Buffy. Here's a taste, in which Harris is singing about the young beauty he met at the local laundromat.
Laundry day, see you there. Under things, tumbling. Wanna say, love your hair. Here I go, mumbling. With my freeze ray, I will stop the world. With my freeze ray, I will find the time to find the words to tell you how you make me feel. What's the phrase? Like a fool, kinda sick, special needs, anyways. With my freeze ray, I will stop the pain. It's not a death ray or an ice beam, that's all Johnny Snow. I just think you need time to know that I'm the guy to make it real. The feelings you don't dare to feel, I'll bend the world to our will, and we'll make time stand still.
Neil Patrick Harris began his career on TV, playing a young genius doctor on Doogie Howser, M.D. And he's there now, playing the womanizing Barney on the CBS sitcom How I Met Your Mother, a role for which he was just nominated for an Emmy. But his musical turn in Dr. Horrible is no accident. He sang the role of Tobias in a West Coast concert version of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd. He then went on to perform other works by Sondheim, including the plum role of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Broadway revival of Sondheim's Assassins. Terry spoke with Neil Patrick Harris in 2005 and asked why he and Stephen Sondheim connected so well.
Steve and I became friends less through the work we were doing together and more through our mutual love of games and puzzles. He's a gamesman, and I love me some puzzles and murder mysteries and that sort of that genre, and he does too. So we started talking about computer games and crosswords, and he used to do a big thing where he'd have people come to his house and he'd have set up this big group puzzle thing where you'd go from room to room and solve puzzles that would take you to sort of a treasure hunt, take you to a clue to another place. And I was infatuated by that idea. I think that stuff is great. And so we became friendly that way. And I think it's better to talk to someone as incredible as Stephen Sondheim about things other than his work, because I think he's probably dealing with people that tell him how great his work is and how amazing he is all the time. So I sort of tried to just talk to him about regular things that I liked, that I knew he liked as well. I'm so impressed by him in a structural way, because he writes music and writes vocal parts with very specific actors' thoughts in mind. Not just how they're going to say the words, but actual thoughts. He'll put a quarter rest instead of an eighth rest or a full bars rest, because the character in his mind is taking time to think of what to say next. Or he'll repeat a stanza twice, and on the third time, the last note will raise up a third step. That's not just because he was bored, but he's actually thinking that the character on the third line is repeating to himself and then realizing something, and that realization would cause you to raise your pitch at a third. So I think, not unlike Shakespeare, he maps out what the actor should do in his mind very specifically in what he does.
Would you apply what you just said to a Sondheim song that you've performed?
Yeah, like Not While I'm Around that Tobias sings has a bunch of weird minor thirds because it's he's in thought process and sort of confused by the whole thing, repeats himself a lot. In Evening Primrose, there's a great song, If You Can Find Me, I'm Here, mm-hmm. that sort of repeats itself a lot, but has little minor changes to it that are as he's walking around, and if he's startled by something, there's a, you know, 2-bar pause while he looks around before he commences again.
I'd like to play your song from Sweeney Todd, Not While I'm Around. And your character in this, you're like the young apprentice of Mrs. Lovett, the character who bakes dead bodies into pies. And the dead bodies are the people that she and Sweeney Todd murder. And the pies become both a way of covering up the bodies and a way of selling cheap pies. And Tobias doesn't realize that Mrs. Lovett is in on these murders. So he sings her this beautiful song in the hopes that he can kind of warn her and protect her from Sweeney. Would you talk a little bit about this song and about any advice or insights that Sondheim gave you about it?
Sure. Tobias is a bit of a simpleton. You know, he was going around selling elixirs with another barber named Pirelli, and I sort of backstoried that he was beaten and abused and a little slow in the brain. Sweeney is a very vengeful, single-minded character who only wants revenge for being put in jail, and this judge who did that, he's trying to fix that wrong. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Lovett is nothing but sort of wistful and a little kooky and sort of infatuated with Sweeney's passion. So Tobias witnesses Sweeney Todd being villainous, but he's sort of too simple to really put all the pieces together. He's not an incredibly articulate person. And his love and appreciation for Mrs. Lovett just comes on a more maternal way. He just never had anyone who was taking care of him be loving. It was always sort of awful and abusive. So Steve's notes to me were just to make sure that as you're singing the Tobias parts, that it's realizations that you're having at the moment. He's not someone who has a lot of foresight or is able to look back and put pieces together. So when he's singing things, he's really coming up with the thought and the idea while he's saying them. And his desire to protect Mrs. Lovett doesn't come from anything that he knows, just something that he feels.
And also, this is a character who's actually kind of weak. He's not only not very bright, but he's not particularly strong. He's not particularly big. He's not particularly.
Yeah, it was originally done on. Yeah, it was originally done on Broadway by Ken Jennings, who is a very who's a smaller, diminutive kind of guy, and I'm 6 feet tall, so he was sort of the archetype that I had to go from. So I sort of added a bit of a limp. I twisted one of my feet in, sort of Kevin Spacey, Kaiser Soze style, and I sort of pitched my voice up a little Mandy Patinkin-ish, and sort of gave him a bit of a hobble. So. Because I didn't want to be physically imposing at all. In fact, I wanted to be a bit sympathetic physically, someone who's not capable of just standing himself up and making the right choice. He has to have others sort of make choices for him, and so I needed to sort of physicalize that and vocalize that. If you hear the song, you'll hear it. My voice is very kind of pingy the whole time. It's not how I normally sing.
May I say you're also doing a little hip-hop thing with your hands? Did you notice that?
Am I hip-hop?
Yeah.
I like to keep it real. You're throw a little gangster
yeah,
in there
yeah, exactly.
as well.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing slightly like hip-hop hands.
Word up.
Was that intentional?
Yes. I threw a little Puff Daddy in there as well, just for the youngsters. You got to play to every demographic, right?
Okay. So let's hear you in this production of Sweeney Todd, which was shown a couple of years ago on public television. And we're also going to hear Patti LuPone in the background.
Nothing's gonna harm you,
Not while I'm around.
Of course not, dear, and why should it?
Nothing's gonna harm you, no, sir. Not while I'm around.
What do you mean, a man?
Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays.
And so they are, dear.
I'll send them howling. I don't care. I got ways.
Of course you do. What a sweet, affectionate child it is.
No one's gonna hurt you. No one's gonna dare.
I know what Toby deserves.
Others can desert you. Not to worry. Whistle, I'll be there.
Here, have a nice bonbon.
Demons will charm you with a smile for a while. But in time, nothing can harm you. Not while I'm around.
That's Neil Patrick Harris from a production of Sweeney Todd, the Stephen Sondheim musical.
It's so strange to hear those things because I'm not really a trained vocalist, so it brings me back to standing there at the New York Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center with that orchestra there and frigging Patti LuPone and George Hearn and all these amazing operatic people. And I sing okay, but I've not, you know, I didn't study for 6 years with some amazing person or anything. I have a vocal coach, but having started on television and then sort of veered into theater, it was definitely one of those pinch me, I can't believe I'm here moments.
Neil Patrick Harris speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Neil Patrick Harris. The latest role for TV's former Doogie Howser is as the singing villain in Joss Whedon's cult internet musical, Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog.
How old were you when you auditioned for Doogie Howser, and how did you find out about the part and even consider auditioning for it?
Well, we never wanted to do TV. The first thing I did was a movie called Clara's Heart with Whoopi Goldberg, and that sort of came about through a gentleman named Mark Medoff, who's a playwright, and he wrote Children of a Lesser God, and he wrote Clara's Heart. I went to a drama camp for a week at New Mexico State University, and Mark thought I'd be right to be in this movie. I ended up getting the movie and got an agent, so that's how my career started. And then we just never wanted to do television because it always would uproot us so much, you know. It was fun and fine to go away for 4 or 6 weeks to Big Bear and make a movie with Patrick Duffy and Lonnie Anderson and have a fun little summer and then go back to your regular life. But the conceit of doing a television show was just so all-encompassing. Both of my parents were attorneys, and it just seemed crazy to uproot us all. So there was one caveat. We said, well, if it's a really good TV show, if it's like a Stephen Bochco show, because my parents loved L.A. Law, being lawyers, loved Hill Street Blues, or if it's something really good like that, then we'll consider it. Well, sure enough, you know, a script comes down the pipe for a little precocious teenage doctor kid by Stephen Bochco, of all people. So we said, we might as well read it, or we might as well audition for it, I guess. And so I had sort of an in. The casting director of that show knew my manager, then agent Bo Shute, very well, and so he thought, you know, he already had sort of an inner track for it. So I got to go meet Stephen Bochco really before casting had even begun. And then sure enough, months later, they hadn't cast the role yet, and I went back in and re-auditioned and got the job, and we were indeed uprooted to L.A., and that was sort of how it happened. It was strange. Not many half-hour shows were one camera by someone who was so noted for doing long-form television, like Stephen Bochco. So it was a bit of a hybrid show at the time, and it was a lot of work.
And you were, what, 14?
No, a little bit older. I filmed the pilot when I was 15, and we started the series properly when I had just turned 16. So it was about 16 to 19.
So did the producers, like, interrogate you to make sure that you could handle, emotionally handle being uprooted and doing television and becoming famous? Did they kind of give you some idea of how this might change your life? Because, you know, it's a big change for anybody, but for particularly like a 15-year-old, you know. So what did they do to prepare you or to test you beforehand?
Stephen Bochco did sit me and my parents down at a restaurant right when it all began and sort of said, look, this is going to be potentially a big chapter in your life and a big giant wave to ride. But he said, please know from experience that the business is not unlike sets of waves and that you can ride one and it's a great ride, but suddenly it crashes on the sand and you have to stand up and shake yourself off and swim back out. And there might be a long period of time before another set of waves come, but trust that the business is lots and lots of waves that keep coming in. And if you can wait it out and hopefully hop on another wave later on, that'll be good. But, you know, I think he was more forewarning us that this wave that we were currently on would inevitably, you know, hit the shore, and that we shouldn't be so, you know, overwhelmed by that. And that was nice to hear. It actually put things in decent perspective.
So who came up with the name Doogie?
That was a friend of Stephen Bochco's, was named Douglas, and his nickname was Doogie. And I think Stephen thought that was a nice way to show an adult's world, but have a sort of child's name, you know, have adult responsibility, but still throw in sort of the adolescent skew. And to have a name like that, to have your parents call you Doogie while you're able to prescribe medicine and doing, you know, vasectomies and whatnot, seemed like a nice juxtaposition.
Was it hard after Doogie Howser to convince casting agents that you could be anybody else, that you could be somebody completely different, and that you could grow up?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's hard for anyone who's on a successful show, sort of known as a person, a specific person for a long time. And I just kept thinking back to what Mr. Bochco said about, you know, waves will come when they will, and you just have to sort of be patient and ride them out. And the theater helped a lot with that, actually. The theater, the casting directors from the theater gave me the shot to play against type. You know, Mark in Rent was very against type. And the MC in Cabaret was this very androgynous, you know, crazy polysexual guy in Weimar, Germany in the 20s. And that I would never have been thought for had that been a feature film or something. So I was sort of given the chance to expand the box and sort of spread my wings a little bit theatrically, I guess.
You had a very funny cameo as yourself in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. And they're driving in their car looking for the White Castle, and they pick you up hitchhiking, and they recognize you. But instead of being the Doogie Howser type, you're just obsessed with, like, scoring, you know, with finding with finding girls.
I'm tripping on ecstasy and
exactly.
Need to get to a strip club. Yeah.
Yes. So, and we can't play a clip of it because the language is totally unacceptable for radio. When you were offered this part, did you immediately say yes? Or, I mean, could you tell when they offered it to you whether the joke was supposed to be on you or with you, if you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. That was the big question. I mean, I would love to separate myself and my image from the Doogie days, but at the same time, I really have incredible respect for the people that created that show. So at no time do I want to be trashing my past or making fun of the work that I've done. If not for me, for the people that spent a lot of time creating that show. So that was my worry was, great, you want to have this extreme kind of messed up version of Neil Patrick Harris. I'm down with that, but is it going to be at the expense of a bunch of bad Doogie Howser jokes and people sort of mocking that? They were sort of didn't get that. They wanted it to be more reverential than they did have it be spoofing me or picking fun at me.
So did that movie, did Harold and Kumar change your image?
I don't know. I mean, I can't determine how my image is seen, but it certainly made me not look so square.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was playing Neil Patrick Harris, but we also made sure that it, in the credits, that it's Neil Patrick Harris as Neil Patrick Harris, not as himself. That I was playing the part of Neil Patrick Harris, who was this sort of, you know, crazy, you know, drug-induced, horny guy. So it was great. I worked for 2 days, and that was like, it turned out to be a good thing. I think Harold and Kumar, that movie ended up getting me Barney and How I Met Your Mother, because without that, I don't think people would have expected me to be so extreme in that way.
Well, Neil Patrick Harris, one final question. 3 names, how come? Why not Neil
Far
Harris?
Far more theatrical. I am a stage actor. No. 3 names. That's my birth name, and there was another Neil Harris in the Screen Actors Guild when we were signing the papers. So we thought about being someone like Neil Danger, or, you know, Neil Patrick Rocket. But we just figured the whole name would be nice for everyone involved. So it stuck.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Neil Patrick Harris, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog can be downloaded on iTunes. Harris also can be seen in Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay, which just came out on DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform, at aecf.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Johnny Carson asked Paul Anka to write his Tonight Show theme. Coming up, we talk with singer-songwriter Paul Anka. He got his start in the music business as a teenage idol. This summer, Anka was awarded the 2008 Johnny Mercer Award by the Songwriters Hall of Fame. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Are My Destiny was one of many songs that made our next guest, Paul Anka, a teen idol in the late 50s and early 60s. He wrote most of his hits. Not only You Are My Destiny, but Diana, Put Your Head on My Shoulder, and Puppy Love. Later, he wrote the song that became Frank Sinatra's anthem, My Way. And at Johnny Carson's request, wrote the theme for The Tonight Show that accompanied Carson for 30 years. Last year, Paul Anka released his latest CD, Classic Songs My Way. Earlier this summer, Paul Anka received the Johnny Mercer Award at the 2008 Songwriters Hall of Fame dinner for his career body of work. In 2005, when Terry spoke with him, Paul Anka had just released a CD on which he sang other people's songs, songs few people expected he'd care about. That CD, called Rock Swings, features swing versions of rock songs from the 1980s and 90s by bands like R.E.M., The Pet Shop Boys, Van Halen, and Nirvana.
One of the songs you do on the new CD is Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, probably their most famous record. Mm-hmm. What did you hear in this as a potential swing song?
Well, it started with the assessment of the charts. When I looked at all the Billboard, you know, I saw the importance of grunge, you know, that whole Seattle movement. The Nirvana record is an anthem. He's a poet in a sense. You know, I understood it intellectually and what and where it was coming from. But when I looked at it, I said, you know, wouldn't it be wild if I could find the groove for this? Because I saw it right away in its melody structure. As a musician, I saw da-da-da-da-ba-ba-da-ba. It does swing. The only thing I had to get over was to assess, you know, lyrically, how much of it, because I left a lot of the song out, how much was I going to use? How did it lay into this real swing shout that is probably one of the best swing shouts on the whole CD are those two instrumental releases. You know, I heard that, and that really hooked me. So I really selected the lyric that when I sung it would be at least believable enough for me once I got it into the pocket. But I knew it was an important challenge. I knew the importance of the group, and I just had to do it. And I've since heard from Dave Grohl, who's with the Foo Fighters, who was a part of the band, and he heard it. He heard me do it on Letterman, and then he heard the record, and he said, man, you know, I didn't recognize that lyric for about 20 seconds, but what a classic and great arrangement and the treatment. He went on and on about it. The reason I say that is because I felt in my heart that, you know, we're all creative people here. We're all part of that mosaic. And if I can create that and take a song that, you know, no one felt really had a chance to go there and really impress one of the guys that wrote it or that was a part of it, then my job is complete. And I've made a huge point there as to not pigeonhole that a good song's a good song.
Well, why don't we hear the original Nirvana version back-to-back with your new swing version of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
I'm worse at what I do best, and
for this. That was Smells Like Teen Spirit, performed first by Nirvana and then by Paul Anka, as featured on Paul Anka's CD, Rock Swings. Oh, Paul Anka, the problem with that lyric as a swing song, and and I know other people have pointed this out too, is, you know, you don't really hear the lyric that clearly on the original record, but when you sing a mulatto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido, yeah, it's just, I don't know that the lyric is meant to be heard that clearly or kind of swung that way. How did you feel, what did you do to try to make that part of the lyric work for you?
Well, I think the key is it is what it is. You know, you can look at abstract art or poetry or of any kind, and, you know, you have to respect, you know, the person that created it. Originally on the original record, you know, the way they mix those records, it's not necessarily let's hide the lyric. The fact is, it is the lyric to the song, and I think that those that grew up with the song, hearing it this way, not unlike taking a film from way back and modernizing it, it's the same analogy. You can't go changing the lyric, but there are people that have identified with it, that understood the original record, and that, you know, you can't sit down and hand out a pamphlet every time you record something as to what it means or what you mean by it. It is what it is. It swings. Those are the words. And if it's poetry in a sense, take it for what it is.
Your first hit when you were 16 was Diana, which was produced by Don Costa, who later became Frank Sinatra's arranger and producer. And at the time, he'd been doing arrangements for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. How did you meet Don Costa?
Well, I left Canada, where I was living at the time, and I wanted to get to New York. I'd already been there prior to meeting Don Costa because I knew that's where the music was. I won a contest collecting soup wrappers for Campbell's Soup. There was an ad in the paper for IGA Food Stores, and it said that if you collected these soup wrappers and put your name behind, put it in the box, that you could be selected, on and on and on. So I won, I got a job at IGA, clocked all the cans leaving, went to the houses. Anyway, I win from my district.
Wait. So you got this job just so you could collect more soup cans? Wow, that's so ambitious.
I was a very ambitious young man. And I won the contest, and I went to New York with 40 other guys from Canada and a little box lunch, went to the YMCA. They put us up, and I really got a sense of the scene down there, Alan Freed, the rock and roll, everything that was happening. So I knew I had to get back there. I had some friends of mine who had a hit record at ABC Paramount called The Rover Boys, a song called Graduation Day, and they steered me over to
Don Costa.
Was that
We'll Remember Always Graduation Day?
Uh-huh. It was a big hit back then. And I was a fan of the Rover Boys, as I was for the Crew Cuts and Four Lads. So I went up to see Don Costa, and he saw this young kid walk in, you know, T-shirt, jeans, in a time when, you know, that wasn't the thing. It's not, you know, like it is today, where you've just got this rash of kids running around making records. And he said, okay, play me something, because they were a new company. And I sat down and just started banging away at the piano, and I played Diana and Don't Gamble with Love and a couple other songs, and that's where it all started. He, you know, said, where's your parents? In Canada. Can we fly them down? Blah, blah, blah. And we signed a contract, and that was the beginning for me. I never went back.
Okay, the song Diana, the lyric is, I'm so young and you're so old.
You're
this
so
my
old.
Darling, I've been told. I've read this was basically about your babysitter.
Well, she sat a couple of times for my brother and sister, but she wasn't on an ongoing basis. She was someone I saw at church. You know, new in the community, small community, Ottawa, Canada. And I saw her from afar most of the time, and then I would, you know, run into her socially at certain gatherings. But back in the 50s, unlike today, you know, if you were older by a few years, if you were taller, if you didn't have a shot. You know, that's what it was back then. And she was all of those things. And but I had this little crush on her, and thus, I'm so young and you're so old. I would play it at parties for my friends. The word would leak out to her, and she thought it was rather cute. I mean, there was no, you know, real spiking of emotion there. And I just went on with it, and I'd put it in my pocket and just kept writing until I had the chance to, you know, originally I started playing those songs for these groups that would come to town, including Chuck Berry, and nobody really paid any attention to me, and that kind of really motivated me to go on and sing my own songs, and that was my first record.
Well, why don't we play it? This is from 1957, Paul Anka singing his song, Diana. Diana.
Paul Anka singing Diana, his first hit from 1957. Terry Gross spoke with him in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with singer-songwriter Paul Anka.
What point did you start thinking about how you were going to make the transition to adult music? And again, just to go back to the 50s and early 60s, it's a time when a lot of adults in the record industry were thinking rock and roll is this like passing phase, and it's not going to last. And a lot of like young rock and rollers are being groomed to play the copa because they were going to become adults soon and they had to make that transition to the adult audience. So what did you think your life would be like as an adult, and what kind of transition did you think you would have to make?
Well, somewhere around 58, 59, I realized that, I was changing and I had to change. I was looking for longevity, and, one has to realize that back then, rock as we know it today, or when it really started in let's say the mid-60s, and you had the Beatles with that form of rock and roll, which was light in 64. Prior to that, there was nothing else around except the Rat Pack. So it was all Frank Sinatra, that kind of music, and oops, who are these little kids with this kind of music that no one liked, including Sinatra. We started saying to ourselves, well, where do we go from here? I mean, look at those guys. They're so cool. I mean, they worked that place, Las Vegas and the Copa, and, we want to be like them. And I'd sit with Bobby Darin, and, he and I had that natural instinct to go that way, and we'd say, we want to be like them. And, one of my earlier albums was called Swings for Young Lovers, and it was an album of all old standards with a big swing band, which was very unusual. And then Darin did his, and, I realized that that's where I wanted to go if I had to survive. And, with my management and agents, all of a sudden I was the youngest kid to work the Copa. Then I was the youngest kid to work Vegas in 59 with Sophie Tucker. And I started to say, yeah, you know what? I think I can survive if I learn my craft and I become a performer. And that's what I pursued. And I really started to sense the foundation broadening, which was going to allow me to maybe sustain myself, because I felt that people were looking at me different, not only as the writer, but this performer and this kid that put this tux on. And then Darin became successful with Mac the Knife. So it really looked like we were on the right course. And then we started to merge with Sinatra. And there I was working with them and learning from them and being around these guys. And that was the final goal for us. And then the Beatles came and changed everything.
When you started hanging out with Sinatra and the other guys in the Rat Pack, what were some of the things about their lives that you wanted to emulate, and other things about their lives that you wanted to make sure to avoid?
Yeah, for sure. You're enamored and flattered being around them and being accepted by them. You certainly weren't one of them, but you were on the periphery, but also allowed in. And you like their sense of style. You like the way they dressed. You certainly like the music. You like the way that they sang. You like the way they performed. For a while, you started getting the habits of, they teach you how to play blackjack. Okay, if you don't lose a lot of money. You watch them drink and smoke. Life is choices. And I looked and saw what it did to them and saw how they suffered from it. And went, I'm not going to be the smoker, and I'm just not going to drink the hard liquor, because I need to function. I want to be in control of what I'm doing. So you learn, both sides of that, what to do and what not to do. But it was very exciting to be around. It was a big learning college for me.
Did Sinatra treat you like the kid?
Yeah, I was the kid. Everybody, we all had our robes in this famous steam room that we all hung out in. And Dino was the Dague. Joy Bishop had a robe, which was one of his sayings, like, what do you think about that? I forget what it was. Sammy was Smokey the Bear. And mine was the kid, and that's what Frank called me, the kid.
And did that seem affectionate to you, or did you feel like you wanted to grow up and not be the kid anymore?
No, I was I was the kid. I was younger. He was very affectionate about it. I liked it. You know, I called him the old man, ultimately. You know, you got with the program. I never felt in any way inferior. I was certainly younger. You know, I was just sitting there watching this incredible candy store unfold in front of me, from JFK showing up and Marilyn Monroe and all these stars, and, you know, all the activity and all the little boy antics.
You know, we were talking about your friendship with Sinatra and some of the things that you learned from him. You wrote the English lyric for the song that became his anthem, My Way. The song pre-existed, but it was a French song with a French lyric, a lyric that was totally different from your English lyric. Mm-hmm. How did you first hear the song, and what made you want to write a new lyric for it?
Well, as I said earlier, I was very much into the whole European culture, and I started spending a lot of time in Europe. I'd gotten married there in Paris, and brought my children every year to the south of France to a house that I had down there that we rented. And I was down in Mougins, which is just a little village south of France, and I was listening to the radio and listening to all of these, you know, modern songs and knowing where they fit. I heard this melody on the radio, and I said, there's something more to that. I'd like to get my hands on it. So I called a friend of mine in Paris, who I was in business with a publishing company, and he said, yeah, I know the guy that has the song, and it's, you know, it's not that big a hit, but what do you want? I said, just give it to me, the rights. He said, fine. He said, I'll call the guy. So I flew up to Paris, and I met with him, and they gave it to me. I mean, there was no money changed hands.
There was no money?
Nothing. There was no work buying the pyramids, nothing. It was real simple, a couple of pages, a piece of paper, and I took this song. I just took it from that form, and I started playing it on the piano into the vibe that I heard. And it was just more classical and structured. And fade out, fade in. I'm in Florida. Sinatra calls, and he said, let's have dinner. I'm doing this movie down here, but let's have dinner tonight. I'll come and see your show. We have dinner. He said, kid, I'm doing one more album with Costin. I'm quitting the business. I'm fed up. I'm getting out. And, you know, he'd been really hassled. Things were going on in his life that he didn't like, and he wanted to quit. So that really moved me. You know, one more album, I'm out of the business. Sinatra, can't believe it. I go back to New York, where I was living at the time, and I started typing. And I said, now, if Sinatra were writing this, you know, what would he say? And I started, and now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain, da-da. And it started to write itself. And I called he and Don Costa, who at the time were out at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And I said, guys, I've got something for the album, and I just, you need to hear this. And about a few months later, I got a call, knowing that they were in the studio, and Sinatra was on the phone, and he was in L.A., I'm in New York. He said, kid, listen to this. And he put the phone up to the speaker, and that was the first time that I heard Frank Sinatra singing My Way. And I just started to cry. It was just the most emotional moment for me, because I'd never really written anything like that, let alone have Frank Sinatra be the messenger of such, you know, a different song in what was going on back then in the late 60s.
Well, why don't we hear Frank Sinatra singing My Way with a lyric by my guest, Paul Anka.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway. More, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew. But through it all, when there was darkness,
Frank Sinatra singing My Way, a lyric written for him by Paul Anka. We'll return to Terry's conversation with Paul Anka after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to an interview Terry Gross conducted with singer-songwriter Paul Anka in 2005. Anka was given the Johnny Mercer Award this summer at the 2008 Songwriters Hall of Fame.
One more thing in the annals of Paul Anka lore, and this is a website that you probably really hate. I'm sure you know about it. There's a website called The Guys Get Shirts that features...
Oh, yeah, I love it. It's great.
It features a really long tirade. Where you're bawling out your band. This was recorded a few years ago, probably surreptitiously.
15 years ago by a real snake that we fired after a month that brought a tape machine in. In fact, we had a nice big moment on it with Howard Stern recently.
Oh, did he play it?
Oh, yeah, he played it, and he listened. He absolutely agreed with it. And he said, look, I've done that. I do that. And everybody does, you know. I mean, I think that any guy running a company gets it. The whole point of that tape, you know, I'm a real stickler for detail, and I have a real strong respectability and responsibility to my audience. And when I'm up on that stage, and anything that I do, it's got to be as perfect as possible for the consumer, for whomever. You know, I don't go to work at night and take the check and run. So what was happening there was a lot of mistakes in the band, in the sense that we'd rehearsed it one way, and then when you have a cutoff or you're doing something, everyone has to end together. And the other was that we'd gone, spent a lot of money on getting guys dressed so that there was uniformity, and whether it was for the TV show or whatever it was, and guys just dropped the ball. You know, a lot of musicians, some of them are drinkers and some of them are doing dope and what have you, and you learn that, you know, later in the gig. It's like hiring people. You know, the resumes are one thing and everybody's on their best behavior, but until you get somewhere into the voyage and realize that, you know, you've got some bad apples in there, that's when you have to deal with it. And yeah, it's a funny tape. You know, listen, that's me, and I'm that way. You know, people don't toe the line, they're out.
Well, you really lay into the band on this, and you say things, when I effing move, I slice like an effing hammer. And
right.
What's it like to really bawl out your band and then be in front of them in a performance? Because when it comes time to perform, you want that band to be really sympathetic and you want them to play in a moving way. So,
They do. They don't even take light of it. We're having dinner together on Saturday night. It's totally meaningless because they're used to that environment. They've done it with Buddy Rich. They've heard it with Sinatra. You know, these are seasoned guys that really, when you show them those mistakes and you ball them out any way you want, they know the personality and the other side of the person. I mean, I've heard, Tommy Lasorda. I mean, there's like thousands of these tapes out there from Orson Welles to Lasorda. And I think we're all indoctrinated with that and get it. So a band, when you're giving them work, and most of those guys are still with me today, you know, they know the personality, they know when they're wrong, they know how to decipher and edit what all of that is. And it really doesn't come to play whatsoever. I mean, when you're doing this 47 years and you're successful on that stage, every entity is working and all the energies are working. And the other side of the coin is, you know, you're the guy that's loaning the money, that you're doing this for their families, that you're bringing them here. So you got to look at the full mosaic. This is not anything new here. This is a small pebble on the whole infrastructure of business where people hear it. I know how to motivate people and how to treat them. And I've been doing that for years. So I have absolutely no regrets for anything on that whatsoever.
Paul Anka, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. His latest CD, Classic Songs My Way, came out last year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Herzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Journalist Thomas Frank says the incompetence of the Bush administration is no accident. It's an attempt by conservatives to deliberately dismantle the machinery of government. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Thomas Frank. His new book is The Wrecking Crew. He's also the author of the bestseller What's the Matter with Kansas? Join us for the next Fresh Air.